I want to talk a little bit about how you spent your summers up in Lake George. So can you tell us about the you seem to have lots of very fond memories of these summers in Lake George.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, Lake George, you know, which is where I vacation still now. Lake George was a kind of a great formative experience in my life earlier on. What happened was that my cousin at Oberlin was brought to Silver Bay up at Lake George. Silver Bay is a YMCA institution right on Lake George in the most beautiful part of it, up close to The Hague. And it is a place for conventions and things of that sort, Christian conventions and other things. It's the most beautiful spot in the world, I think. And my cousin got a job there with the chef. We had an all-black crew up there, right? They brought in this whole all-black crew and half professional cooks. And these cooks were great guys. I mean, they were funny. And then they brought in college kids. So the chef, Chef Douglas, brought in my cousin and myself, and he made us into chefs, right? We started out as pot washers, and then we started out as pot washers, and then he made us into, you know, third cooks and stuff like that. So I spent 4 summers up there, all my summers up there in college, and it was a wonderful experience for me. It was definitely a broadening of my world. I mean, because there were college kids from all over the country who came to work there, from Oberlin, right, from out in the Midwest, right? And it was fascinating. There were no black college, there were no black imps. They have something called imps. That is, people who just were college kids who come to work there. They don't get paid anything, basically a little amount of money and room and board. And they're there to just, you know, be mixed with other college kids and enjoy the canoes and the water and all that kind of thing. But the cooks were black. And it was funny. We were paid good money. We got close to $100 a month plus room and board. I mean, we were really paid. But we enjoyed the place like everybody else. Now, that created a lot of tension because Silver Bay and its director, and folks whose name I'll just leave out is, but basically, Silver Bay was still segregated. And they had a lot of Southern visitors coming up. And these Southern visitors didn't like seeing black men, right? Because there were no black women up there, around white women. But the white women were attracted to us, right? Because we were, you know, bright, strong dudes, right? Whatever, right? And so there was one guy one time, I'll never forget this. We was sitting on the porch up there at Silver Bay. And I was sitting with somebody, a white girl, and so was my cousin. And this man came out, and it was a Southern accent, strong Southern accent. He looked at us, and he looked at his wife, and he said, "You know one thing, Sally," he said, "I like Silver Bay, but there are too many Georges around here." That's what he said, "Too many Georges around here." In any case, Silver Bay opened me to my kind of first encounter with a white female, you know, and the first kind of opening of the kind of sexual divide. And so it, again, you know, my world is becoming bigger and wider, and my horizons are constantly becoming broader. And and funny thing about Silver Bay, they integrated the cooking staff after they found that they were paying us, and we were bright kids. Well, why couldn't they do this to white kids? So they integrated the cooking staff, and then they paid everybody less. Right. So, anyhow, it's still a wonderful place, and I love it. And whenever I ride in the car, and I look out there and I just see everything. I see sometimes all the old folks, all the kids and stuff like that. And I see us again. Sometimes I'll come down by boat and just kind of, you know, anchor off, you know, just hover off of Silver Bay, look at it and stuff like that. It's a marvelous, marvelous place.
You did very well at Kenyon. You graduated with honors.
Yeah.
You and then you received a Fulbright, I believe.
Yeah.
Could you tell us about your travels to France on that Fulbright?
Yeah. Well, I got onto the, I was going over on the Queen Mary. And my dad drove me up and left me off on the Queen Mary. I got on the Queen Mary in New York City. And I go to my room, my cabin, I've got a black roommate, a male black roommate. So I talk to him, and he says to me, "This ship is segregated." I couldn't believe this. I mean, it's my very first time here in this place. He says, "This ship is segregated." So, again, it's like you're constantly fighting this white world. I mean, constantly, every damn place, every time you turn here, turn there. It's a fight. It's nothing is normal. Well, I ended up going to the upstairs and the bursar, or the purser, I forget what his name is, and the guy who does the assignments for the tables assigned me to a black table. Well, had me sit at a table for two, and I sat there, and then came over a black young woman who was also a Fulbright scholar. Her name was Julia Fields. She's a very well-known poet. And she sat down with me. And, you know, that was the way it was supposed to be, segregated. Now, I was at this point angry because I'm getting ready to get up. But I'm not going to get up and leave Julia sitting there. And just at that point, because I was going to, you know, protest this kind of thing, and just at that point comes across Professor John T. Flanagan, who was going to be the Fulbright kind of professor at the University of Bordeaux, which is where I was going. And he had his three daughters with him and his wife. He came over to our table, and he said, "I want you all to join us." And the bursar came over. When the bursar came over, he looked at him and says, "Sir, I want these youngsters to come over to my table." And that put an end to it. From then on, you know, we sat at Professor Flanagan's table or anywhere else that we wanted to sit. And Julia with the same thing. So there was another black guy there who was going to Bordeaux with me, a fellow by the name of Smith, and he was going to be a great Bob Smith. He was a great friend of mine later on. Yeah,
you have a number of stories through the book in which individuals make choices there at that split moment where they make a choice either to accommodate themselves to the system or to challenge it. And I think that runs through the book, and here is an example of someone who is taking an active role in challenging the system.
Yeah, he was just a wonderful man, Professor Flanagan, and he made his home. Actually, when we were in Bordeaux, his home was a home for all of us, for all the Fulbright students there. Just a great man. Yeah.
All right, so you get to France. What happens in France?
Ah, France. France, for us, being black, was like paradise. Totally paradise. The French people love black people. I mean, it was just amazing. You go there, and once we got on the boat train, everybody, you know, was nice to me. And, you know, Bob Smith by now, Bob was a military veteran. And he was a sergeant. He'd gone all the way through the war. But Bob was a Fulbright. He spoke French fluently. So Bob was with me. And wherever we went, everybody was nice to us. It was astounding to me. It was astounding to see white people, because by now, you know, you're always under the American system of the way it is or was, you know, you're suspicious of whites. You just don't have, in France, it was not like that. You could get, once we hit Paris and the Latin Quarter, which is where we were, right, for a while, you could go sit any place, right? You'd see blacks and whites mixed together. You'd see, you know, Asians sitting with Africans and with whites. It was a total paradise in terms of racial amalgamation. There was a place, a very famous place, the Café de Tournon, which was the headquarters of the intellectual headquarters of the black community there. And it was really kind of headed by Richard Wright, who sat there and looked basically at this table outside and who held court there, you know, all day long. And black intellectuals would come right in and out. Ollie Harrington, right, the great cartoonist, James Baldwin, a writer who on Chester Himes, who was a great criminal novelist. He was a great novelist, right? They'd all come floating in. George Carter, who was an Army veteran from Philly, actually, who worked for the USIA, and a guy by the name of Rudy Agri, who was a descendant of Agri from Ghana and who worked for the USIA and who had a very kind of close contacts with all these folks here. Anyhow, I ended up living in a hotel right down the street from them for a whole 6 weeks while I was in Paris. And I had a friend by the name of Bill Smith, William Gardner Smith, who was a well-known black writer, who was part of this whole coterie. And Bill kind of introduced me into this group. And I'd go up there in the evenings. Bob would come along sometimes. We'd go up there in the evenings and just sit around. And it's just amazing listening to the talk. But the talk was always of white people. Always. Just total kind of concentration. I mean, they didn't talk about writing. They talk about this. They didn't talk about that. There's one daggone thing. And I think when I'm sitting here thinking, it probably is just like when Lenin was in exile, you know, away, and the communists were in exile, away from Russia. That's probably all the same thing they talked about was, you know, the Tsar's regime. You know, the same thing. Because it kind of focused all that energy on the enemy, and you're in a situation where you can do that. So they did this. And I enjoyed those conversations. I never was part of the conversations, really. You know, these guys, you know, I'm a youngster. And so I'd sit on the periphery, right in a chair outside and listen to them. But it was good to listen. And I should point out that, again, there are no black women there. There are only white women there. It was a totally interracial environment. And they all had white girlfriends. All of them. Except Baldwin, right? Okay, right. And what else can I say about it? Paris was a kind of a place where you knew who you were. That is, you were black, but you didn't have to feel like that anymore. You felt totally like a person, and that you were being judged like a person. When I went to Bordeaux and I studied there under a couple of wonderful professors whose names need not be here, but wonderful, great French academicians, their attitude towards me was one of, you know, you're a scholar, and that's, you're here as a scholar. not a perception in any way, no perception of, hey, they're surprised to see a black man walk into their office. No. Everything was just kind of totally clear.
Yeah. Did you ever wonder or explore why that was?
Oh, yeah. Well, I did explore to some extent. And, you know, it came from, I think, the World War I experience with the African troops who had fought, in particular the Senegalese, who were so highly thought of by the French and who were fierce fighters at a time when black African-American troops, you know, were looked down upon and stuff like that. By American commanders, the French valued the contribution of these Africans from the colonies. Of course, as you look on, I mean, this was a whole period of the 19, and then, you know, there are great writers. Alexandre Dumas was black. They just had this tradition. I think what do you start looking at? You start looking at the revolutionary tradition. You know, the revolutionary tradition in France, and you know, égalité fraternité, and the way in which they had colonized was different. You know, the French felt that everybody was going to be made French. And that's what was amazing, again, to me. You know, you'd see French black administrators, and you see French black representatives in the Assemblée Nationale. You'd see representatives who were from the colonies, but they were black, and it was not for a black person in a situation where the whole Congress, you know, our whole Congress was totally white, right? You know, you say to yourself, where in the, except for Adam Clayton Powell, right? You say to yourself, you know, how in the world can this be? You know, and it was a different tradition. The French is a socialistic, right? When it's all said and done, right? It's out of Rousseau, right? It's from the people, right? And it was a different place. Right? It had its flaws.
Did you ever, you were talking about the black intellectuals and them having white women lovers, and yet they were talking about white and the yeah. segregation. Did you ever wonder about the contradiction in that? I mean, where was that coming from? Did you ever wonder about any contradiction in that?
No, I don't think there was ever a contradiction. It's a strange thing. I think what really took place down there and what was really happening was, number one, what does the white man in the United States prize the most? What does a white man in the United States, what's the main thing he hates? He hates a black man with a white woman. All right, that's what you hate? Okay, buddy, I'll deal with that. And that's where I think it came from, when all is said and done. All right. And then, of course, actual relationships developed, because people are people. And it wasn't an avoidance of black women, because I think what happened was that in Paris, it seemed to me there was not an equivalent colony of black women. A lot of these guys were army veterans, and they had means of survival there because they had a GI Bill and stuff like that. A lot of the black colony in Paris was that. And there was not an equivalent, you know, as I say, cadre of African-American women there. But there were a lot of French women around, and also German women and Scandinavian women and things of this sort. So it was a natural environment to which they were placed. And I don't think they did it on purpose, but like I said, you know, if the white man wants you, that's what the white man hates, okay, fine. This is what we'll do.
Interesting.
Yeah.
What were you studying in Bordeaux?
I studied in Bordeaux mainly French culture. Actually, I had my professor was Professor Duverger, and I was actually studying the role of the préfecture, that is the French administrative governor, during World War II in the occupied territories of the Vichy regime. And I wish I'd studied it more now because I would have learned more about what happened with them and with the Jewish population at the time. But I didn't. I was basically just a kid trying to do that. So that's what I studied. But basically, Professor Duverger looked at me. He said, look, he says, I want you to enjoy France. He said, I want you to broaden yourself. I want you to read as much as you can. Come to my lectures. Now, at the end of the semester, at the end of the year, I want a report from you on what you've done about the préfecture. So I really didn't do much work on that. I did attend a lot of language classes, and I learned French literature under a Professor Escarpi. I read French literature. That's what I primarily did. And I used to hang out in the cafes with the other Fulbright students.
In the book, you mentioned in passing and in conversations with me, you talk about Gordon Heath and another cafe, very famous cafe.
Yeah.
I thought you might talk a little bit about them and maybe play us a song. You have your guitar here. Maybe play us a song you learned or you remember from that period.
Oh,
if
yeah.
not, something else.
Yeah, okay, maybe I will. Yeah, the place you're talking about is called L'Abbaye. L'Abbaye. There was this great little cafe in a nightclub in Paris called L'Abbaye. And it was run by two people, Gordon Heath and Lee Payan. And these guys were homosexual lovers from New York City, and they were refugees from New York City. It's right after the war. Gordon Heath was a great actor and, famous actor because he had played in a play on Broadway right after the war.
Now, Gordon, he was black, but was Lee black also?
No, Lee Payan was white.
Was white.
And since they were in this relationship, they couldn't really live together in New York at that time. That's the way it was. So they came to Paris, and they formed this, they bought this little place right down in the Latin Quarter. And when you went in there, they both were guitarists. Now, Lee was a great guitarist, right? And Gordon Heath was a great singer, but he also could play, right? And they would just sing folk songs. You go in there, and on each table there was a candle, and you would kind of request your song. And when you requested the song, right, they'd sing a song, whatever it might be, and then they'd snuff out it with a candle. They snuff out the candle, and then you couldn't request another song. After every song was played, right, they would, you could not applaud. Everybody would click their fingers, and that's where it was. Well, this was a wonderful place. I mean, this was the center of actually a lot of Americans coming in here. Rita Hayworth came in there all the time, the great actress, right? And Art Buchwald, who was a famous columnist for, the Washington Post and the Herald Tribune, he would hang out there all the time. He just loved the place. You see him, Art Buchwald, in there practically every night you get it going there. And I can't think of a more kind of ideal place. That's where I took my girlfriend in France. It was just a nice atmosphere. So I will play one of the songs. They used to sing so many songs, but, let's see if I can do this. I'll just sing a la Claire Fontaine. This is a song about, the fellow who goes out to take a bath under a tree, and he sees up there sees up there birds singing, and he says, sing, birds, sing. You have a happy, happy heart, As for me, my heart's been broken because my mistress left me, and she left me because I didn't buy her a bouquet of roses. And it's a sad song, but it's also one of the most beautiful French folk songs, and I love it very much. I sing it now. When I actually sing it, sometimes I actually think still back on those days. Like, à la claire fontaine, je me suis promené. J'ai trouvé l'eau si belle que je me suis baigné. Il y a longtemps que je t'aime, jamais je ne t'oublierai. Sous les feuilles d'une chaîne, je me suis fait veiller. Sous la plus haute branche, le rosine je l'ai chanté. Il y a longtemps que je t'aime, jamais je ne t'oublierai. Chante, Roselyne, je le chante, toi qui as le cœur si bien. Tu as le cœur rire, je m'as jamais bien pleuré. Il y a longtemps que je t'aime, jamais je ne t'oublierai. Je voulais que j'ai perdu ma maîtresse, pas l'avoir mérité pour un bouquet de roses que je lui ai trouvées. Il y a longtemps que je t'aime, jamais je ne t'oublierai. Je voudrais que les roses soient encore arrosées, et que moi et ma maîtresse soient dans les mêmes amitiés. Il y a longtemps que je t'aime, jamais je ne t'oublierai. Long time, 'cause I'm